Now, as promised, we're going to take a look at the world of cinema once again, but this time in conjunction with the world of urbanism. Hong Kong being a city, it's a subject very close to the hearts of many of our film directors. You can't really escape it. Now, we're going to be joined in the studio, we are joined in the studio by Dr. James Clapp, a Fulbright visiting professor at Ling Nan University. He is here to get involved in the new course on urbanism and cinematic study at Ling Nan University, and also to share some of his research with us. So, Dr. James Clapp, very good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Paul.
Now, urbanism and cinematic study. First, we should clear up. Your specialty is the urbanism side, specifically,
it is.
Isn't it?
That's correct.
So, urbanism and cinematic study, I mean, how did you get into that, and what is it?
Well, actually, I had a former Hollywood film director walked into my office one day at San Diego State University, and that was sort of the beginning of it. He was interested in urbanism, and I'd always had somewhat of an interest in film. We formed a partnership at that time until his death in 1988, and a course called The American City in the Cinema was our joint creation, and I've sort of continued on with that because I've had this long time interest in the fact that the American city, our America, let's say, really becomes an urban nation right around the same time that cinema gets developed in America.
Right, so, we're talking late 19th century here, aren't we?
That's correct, right? And I mean, America was more urban than rural by 1920, and of course, this was sort of the beginning of American film. So it really, in a sense, is the first art form to come along that could be a mirror that could be held up to the American city. And then there was, this reciprocity between both the city and the cinema in the fact that the cinema in America probably never would have developed, or for that matter developed anywhere, were it not for an urban culture and an urban society and the kind of technology and audience, of
right.
course, that was necessary for that. So the two seemed a natural, and even though my background was in urban economics and political economy and town planning and those kinds of practical applications, I've always carried along with me this very deep interest in how the arts and the humanities might make a contribution to our understanding as to something as complex as urbanism.
Is it for you a purely academic interest, or were you a film fan anyway?
Well, I've always been a film fan, and I suppose I grew up with, I grew up in New York, which is sort of a film capital, and then I moved to California, which of course is the bi-coastal other side of it.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up Saturday afternoons going to the movies, like most
just
kids
like
in
all
era.
Of us, that's right.
Right.
Yeah. So when you're talking about urbanism, cinematic study, I mean specifics, what will you be looking at?
Well, basically we look at feature film and how over the course of development of feature film, that is stuff that's shown in Pacific Plaza and so on, that how American directors and writers of film have taken the process of American urbanism, immigration, industrialism, social class, crime, the future of the city, all of these kinds of subjects that are of interest or should be of interest to anyone who's interested in studying urbanism, and how they have translated these into a popular forum that then becomes part of the way in which we begin to view our own urbanism. And I mean, it's like most mirrors that art forms are. It's a way in which we see how the popular consciousness of American urbanism gets created. For example, I noticed when I moved to California, being a New Yorker, that most Californians, at least those who had not had any particular personal encounter with New York, saw New York primarily through the movies. Mm. They saw New York as a place that they had seen in maybe a film like Dead End or something of that sort that was made in the 1930s, or the great Bowery Boys films that I grew up on. So a lot of the consciousness, and I suppose this would apply to Hong Kong as well, a lot of what we see, you know, maybe a lot of Americans think Hong Kong is a place where there are Jackie Chans jumping from building to building.
No doubt they do. No
yeah.
doubt. I mean, certainly, Hong Kong, good example that most people that I know of who haven't been here do believe it's all skyscrapers and the like, and that can only have come through not just film, but also television programs, which always concentrate on those kind of things. So
very much so. That aspect ratio that the director decides to give the viewer to look at is what we kind of come away with. And in some sense, our peripheral vision of the city. And of course, part of my course is concerned with that, with bringing in that periphery and also bringing in some of the reality, because remember, film is not about a feature film, at least, is not about documenting things accurately. It's narrative, and it's about telling stories and so forth. So you do get a bit of distortion. Sometimes the city looks like a Funhouse Mirrors version mm-hmm. of the city.
I mean, the film does take all different angles, in fact, doesn't it? I mean, some, as you point, then their role is not specifically documentary, but some do have the gritty realism aspect, and some of them just go for the, you know, this is incredible kind of stuff. You know, what kind of a place is a city? So are you looking at both angles?
Yes. I try to approach this course that I'm doing for the students at Lingnan now. I try to approach it in the broadest possible way, because sometimes we use an example of a film as a way in which the reality really is at variance with what, let's say, the statistics show, or the more formalized kinds of studies of cities. And there are other occasions in which I think there are films that give a very neatly capsulized synopsis of aspects of urbanism that, in other cases, there are rather prolix and thick and opaque kinds of ways of trying to appreciate. So sometimes that really opens the students' eyes, or at least, you know, forms in their view, something that they can then continue to approach in the more formal academic ways.
Are there specific films that you use on the course?
Indeed, there are. Some of the films that I've begun the course with from the students at Hong Kong University, I think, are a bit of a revelation to them, because they had not seen silent black and white films from the 19s and so on. And so at first they're waiting for the sound and wondering where that is, and then wondering whether I'll adjust the set for the color. Obviously, these are, you know, young people, 19, 20, 21 years old, and they're mm-hmm. used to seeing contemporary feature films. But they also are surprised by the amount of kind of information, even documentary information, that's carried in films. Let's say by Charlie Chaplin's The Immigrant. I began mm-hmm. the course with immigration because, of course, America is such an immigrant country. Chaplin's film, The Immigrant, and Easy Street were very much a revelation to them. Some of them had never seen a film like Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
Right, I was wondering whether that was going to be on it.
I use that to introduce themes like the city and industrialism, and how we are dealing with the machine and so forth. And then we'll continue on. They'll see films like Midnight Cowboy about social alienation. So a number of the films are those that have been award-winning films and are part, I suppose, of the canon of American film. So they'll see probably 15 or 20 films during the course of the term, a lot of them that they hadn't seen before.
You've got Mean Streets on there as well.
Mean Streets, yeah. Scorsese, of course, is a great interpreter of the American city. So there's a couple of Scorsese films in there as well.
Right.
That they'll see.
And, of course, urban life is not just big city, but there's also a small town as well. You're dealing with that, sort of the Frank Capra-esque kind of thing.
That's right. Know. That's right. America was never supposed to be a country of big cities, you know. I mean, certainly Jefferson and the other founding fathers thought we would be a nation of yeoman farmers and small townspeople with an occasional big city here and there. And, of course, we turned out to be quite different from that. And part of that, how shall I say, coming of age of America to urbanism, to high urbanism, is in a sense kind of wiped out the small town in the American consciousness. And yet that Hollywood held on to that. And many an immigrant who came to America, Capra himself, an immigrant from Italy, saw the Americans primarily in regionalist terms. They saw us not in terms of big city people, but as common men, and the kinds of people that were played by George Bailey, the protagonist of It's a Wonderful Life, which is a great mm-hmm. Capra film from 1946. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a good thing for certain Hong Kong students to get exposed to about how American life has developed from this period. Certainly this is also an immigrant area too. And there are some small towns, as I saw in a documentary on TV last night. There's even a small town that's trying to hold on to its little bit of turf here in Kowloon, but, you know, is under threat.
Right.
But that small town consciousness continues in a mythic way in America, in spite of the fact that we continue on our way towards hyper-urbanism. we still find that when we conduct surveys, and this is one of the things I talk about when I screen that film for the students, when we do conduct surveys, we find that about 26-27% of Americans still say they would like to live in a small town, where you only have maybe 5 or 6% who I suppose are really small town people, and another 5 or 6% who are rural. The farm is another category that I talk about, how the farm was part of the American tradition. We were all supposed to be yeoman farmers and so on. And we really don't have, I'd say in the last 40 or 50 years, we've gone from there being somewhat like 3 million family farms in America to maybe 220,000 that are left and declining. So in some sense, the city has come to the countryside in America because what we have is agribusiness. What mm-hmm. we have are our farms, our huge factories for producing enough food not only to feed Americans but many other people in the world. But it's primarily petrochemicals and herbicides and pesticides and now genetically engineered foods. And the average California farmer makes about $700,000 or $800,000 a year.
That's not
bad. Not a yeoman farmer.
Certainly not.
Uses a lot of water, too.
I mean, just moving away from the film aspect for a moment and looking at that, the idea of small towns, and so many Americans say they'd like to live in a small town, but of course that's not really where the work is, generally speaking. But is that changing now, you see, with the IT revolution coming along, that people can work from home, can work from anywhere in the world? Are you seeing changes?
Well, the changes in transportation and communication have certainly had their effect on American urbanism in terms of how it shapes the morphology of an urban region, you know, what in Britain you'd call conurbations, these huge metropolitan sorts of regions. Yes, it's possible for people to live on a hilltop in the countryside, quite distant from a lot of things, and tap into the NASDAQ and the Hang Seng and all the other kinds of things, and those sorts of things. But those are for the people whose work is primarily information technology based. But for the average worker, no, they have to remain within the commutation orbit of a major metropolitan area. And although the urban morphology has changed, you take L.A. and Denver and Phoenix and places like that as the new cities of America, they're very horizontal kinds of cities, and they're polynucleated. That is, they're multi-centered. You don't have the traditional strong, inwardly focused downtown, but now you have these constellations of concentration, somewhat like the new territories,
right,
where you have new towns cropping up over the place. This is, in a sense, the new urbanism in America. And so, in a sense, there's both centrifugal forces at work, like information technology that will spread things out, but there are still these centripetal attractions that pull people to keep them within some kind of orbit of metropolitanism, because there's still a degree of human contact that is necessary, that people find necessary. In fact, there were these information technology centers that were set up by some auspices where people wouldn't have to commute all the way to the center city. They could stop and there'd be an office building with a terminal and computers and so on. And they found that it didn't work. These weren't as successful as they thought they were going to be. This is in California. That a lot of people still needed to get to the office, they needed to have contact with people, they needed to go out to lunch, particularly people who are in finance and in the trade of ideas. There's still this necessity for, it seems, for some people to be eye to eye and mm-hmm. to actually shake hands with somebody.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll get over that someday, but right now we're in
there's somewhere to go, but perhaps it'll never happen. Perhaps we don't really want what we think
not.
We want at the moment. And I mean, just going back to the film aspect in that case then, when you're looking at small towns, I mean, would you study someone like David Lynch, who's got one of these really skewed views of small town life?
Yeah, my view of small towns is that they, as I think I said before, they remain in somewhat in the mythic consciousness. Americans hold on to them as that there's always some place that I might be able to escape to. If even, you know, maybe the great small town movie, is Emerald City with Dorothy.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
it's
right.
This place, but there's no place like home, and home usually is a metropolitan. It's usually some part of a metropolitan region. Of course, the compromise that Americans make is the suburb. It's that amalgam of town and country that is approachable in America primarily because of the automobile, has drawn a lot of space into this commutation orbit of the American center city, and that in many respects is where the American dream lies. Actually, it's something I treat in the film course as well. I do the suburb as that part of American consciousness that I suppose is this dream of the best of town and country, and this dream of owning your own home and knowing your neighbors and so on. And there actually is a form of urban planning in America now that I don't know whether it's going to how popular it will become, but it's called neo-traditionalism, if that's not oxymoronic. but basically, it is trying to recreate this small-town atmosphere in developments, even down to the architecture and so on. I tend not to be very much a proponent or, let's say, find this as a very likely new trend in American urbanism. I think it might be fashionable in some quarters, because the problem is that we might be able to create neo-traditional places that look like small towns, places that look like Frank Capra sets, okay? But where are the neo-traditional people? Mm-hmm. Actually, a film like Capra's Wonderful Life is about a young man who really doesn't want to live out that small town life, who really wants the larger world. So this is Americans, and this is the great thing I think about American film as well as its urbanism, is that there's this dynamic tension between our dreams and the kind of urbanism that we're able to put together. I think an aspect of being an urban person is to be somewhat unsatisfied, always mm-hmm. to be questing, and always part of my definition of an urban person is somebody who thinks they can actually make things better, that the next iteration of urban life will be better than this.
Seems
one.
A fair summing up. And I think sure. On the idea of neo-traditionalism, the kiss of death could be given by the fact that Prince Charles back in Britain is advocating exactly that. So it'll never work.
That ends that one.
It certainly does. What do the other urbanists think of this idea of bringing film into the study of urbanism? I mean, are there the traditionalists out there who say, it's just going to mess the students up, they don't know, or is it being quite enthusiastically welcomed?
Actually, I don't know how. I think it's being used more in classrooms today. I gave a presentation in Toronto a couple of years ago on this course to an international urban planning convention, and it was very heavily attended. And judging by at least by that, and the number of requests that I had in email for me to send the syllabus that you've seen to various people, I think that there's probably a critical mass of us that are interested in this and are going to carry it forward. I know that right here in Hong Kong now, I'm going to be involved this spring in a conference that is going to be looking at, it's being directed out of Chinese University by another Fulbright scholar, but it's going to be looking at the new identity of Hong Kong after the handover and so forth, and how that's been expressed in films like Chinese Box and Chung Cheung Express and so on. So I think we're taking this this art form seriously into the classroom in terms of what it says and what it doesn't say. Both are, I think, pedagogically useful.
Right. Well, I hope so too. It sounds fascinating. I'm tempted to get along to it myself. Right. So that's taking place over the next academic year, is that?
Indeed,
at the
moment, it is. Yes.
At Lingnan University.
Correct.
Okay. Well, the students will love it, I'm sure. Dr. Mm-hmm. James Clapp, visiting Fulbright professor at Lingnan University. Thank you very much indeed for joining us in Hong Kong today.
It's been a pleasure.